First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Woke ideology or accurate American history? Good morning. We're live with you from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, why outrage grows over the governor's latest move to ban an AP high school class in African American studies. Have you heard about this? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, photographer Doug Eng on his new exhibit. City Council candidate Kim Stevens Perry and the Donna Marathon turns 20. All of that ahead. But first this hour, the battle over a new advanced placement African American studies course that's not being allowed in Florida schools is now going to court. A group of students and elected officials say they'll file a lawsuit against the state for banning the course. During Wednesday's announcement of this in Tallahassee, Florida civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump was joined by three Florida AP Honors African American high school students. Here's Crump.
These three young people will be the lead plaintiffs in a historic lawsuit. Everybody who is here in America, you have a right to have your culture, your history respected and taught to the children of America.
So what's this all about? Will Brown of Our Own Jacks Today joins us now in studio with more. Hey, Will.
Good morning.
Good to see you. And everyone, what are your questions about the governor and the state's decision to ban an AP African American Studies course from Florida classrooms? Give us a call, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJacks. Facebook open as well. So before we get into why the governor decided to ban this class, Will, what would this class have taught?
There's so much rich history in our country that Black people and Black Americans have contributed to, and this class would go into further depth about it. To prepare for our discussion today, I spoke with my 88-year-old aunt who taught history in public schools in Florida for decades and taught an African-American history class. It was an elective in the early 1970s. Mm. And, you know, she reaffirmed that Black history is American history. And the class that she taught in the early 70s would just go into more depth about some of the heroes and sheroes of Black history. Some things that happened here in Florida that would likely be in a class of this, because I took an African-American history class in college. It was the only mandated class of all the classes at Florida A&M University. But everything from the Rosewood Massacre in 1923, Ocoee in Orange County having no Black people for multiple decades because some folks tried to vote. And because they tried to vote, folks came with shotguns and shot and killed a couple of them and literally ran them into the orange groves. And Ocoee didn't have Black residents for decades. It would be about Harry and Harriet Moore, who were teachers and NAACP activists who had the gall to try and help with voters' rights and get Black teachers equal pay in the public school system in the 1940s and to register Black people to vote. And what happened to them was a bomb was placed under their house on Christmas Day, 1951. Those are the kind of things that would be in an African American studies course to explain where Black history has been and where it's going currently.
Now, on Tuesday, the College Board said it will release official framework for AP African American studies. This is for high schools. And this would replace what's called the pilot framework, which was used to test the course in several schools across the country. In other words, this was a pilot of a class, it sounds like, and Florida's Department of Education decided not to allow the class based on that framework. They say the class lacked educational value and violated state law. The governor said the course was clearly designed for political purposes. What does he mean by that?
Anything that he doesn't agree with is probably political. I mean, that's what he's shown often in his four plus years as governor. Commissioner of Education Manny Diaz over the weekend released the concerns that the Florida Department of Education had. And, you know, among them was they profess that intersectionality is foundational to critical race theory. It's, again, worth repeating that critical race theory is not taught in Florida K-12 schools. I doubt that it is taught in undergraduate courses. I think it is a high-level graduate or law school course. So if you're taking a class that has any type of critical race theory in Florida, my understanding is you are well past undergraduate. So to the idea that it's being taught in schools is a stretch. But there are issues with intersectionality and queer studies. But I went and looked up the definition of intersectionality. And it is systems of inequality based on gender, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender identity, disability, and or class to create unique dynamics and effects. So essentially, if someone is discriminating, let's use myself for example, if someone is discriminating against me, is it because I'm black or is it because I grew up or because of the class I grew up in as a child? Intersectionality would help break it down and understand which is the
case. this pilot class of AP African American Studies for high schoolers, it would have taught the concept of intersectionality.
That's what the state says. That's what the state says. That my understanding is it might have vaguely touched on it, but it wouldn't have gone into in depth. You know, and again, I asked my aunt about this because I trust experts. She brought up a good point. She's like, who is it going to hurt? The people who were going to take that class, they were going to learn it anyway. And her point is, if you're taking an AP course, you're already very smart. You're already very curious. And if you're taking an AP African American Studies course, you want to know this information anyway. So you're going to find out one way or the other, either in school or out.
The lawsuit is on the way, as we heard. State lawmakers, civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump, Florida high school students vowing to sue. When we talk about the legal precedent around these kinds of battles, we could look to the state of Arizona, for example. That state previously tried to ban Mexican-American studies for students, and it was found that doing so violated Arizona students' constitutional rights to learn their Mexican-American history. So we'll have to see how the legal battle plays out. But what about this prospect of students and activists and state lawmakers joining together to sue over this?
We'll see what the ramifications of suing are. I think from a personal perspective, I think it's fascinating that the College Board's going to release its new curriculum on the first day of Black History Month.
This is all happening as we begin Black History Month. Yeah.
Right. And again, it's worth noting that Black history is American history, and without Black folks and others, America would not be the country that we are today. So what the status of the lawsuit is, who knows? We'll have to wait to see what's filed and what's said in the suit. I think I listened in to part of what Mr. Crump said yesterday, and they said if this is not allowed, that they'll file suit. We're kind of in a holding pattern right now.
An email from a listener points out the state is opposing this course, which would be offered as an elective because it would promote reparations. Can you speak to that, Will? Reparations for the descendants of former slaves.
I mean, even if they did promote it, is it going to happen? I mean, there are all sorts of ideas that are discussed, whether in class or just within communities, doesn't mean that the government is going to adhere to, it doesn't mean the government's going to hear the cries and hear the pleas of people for a specific policy. So, the idea of reparations is, I won't say the idea of reparations, but the idea of teaching reparations, because if I recall, folks were promised 40 acres and a mule, and that never happened. So, it might just be yet another empty promise.
Now, just this morning, Gary Fineout of Politico in Florida is reporting that the storm associated with the state's decision to reject this AP African American Studies class is reverberating beyond the Sunshine State's borders. As we cast our eyes up to Illinois, where that governor, Governor J.B. Pritzker, a Democrat who is also seen, by the way, as having his own presidential aspirations, he has written a letter to the College Board warning that his state will not accept the watering down of history, in his words, that the College Board might do in response to criticisms from DeSantis. He calls the decision by DeSantis to pressure the College Board around this course troubling, and said it is being done in order to fit Florida's racist and homophobic laws. That's a quote by Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. He goes on to say that the College Board should refuse to bow to political pressure that would ask you to rewrite our nation's true, if sometimes unpleasant, history. One governor should not have the power to dictate the facts of U.S. history to appease extremists like the Florida governor and his allies. And so, in the context of next year's presidential race, this is yet one more flashpoint in what is rapidly ramping up to be some bitter rhetoric between some of these potential national political figures all over Florida high school classrooms.
Yeah. And the beauty of history and something that students would be taught in history is there's been similar rhetoric like this before in American history. So that's what the beauty of history is it giving specific documentation of when things happened and what people said. I go back to what my aunt said. You know, she said, you know, Black history should be taught. It's not that you can't teach it in American history. I taught it in American history and no one complained about it. And that was in the 70s. She says that the difference between when she was teaching and now is that people, politicians specifically, are inserting themselves more into the educational process than was the case when she was a teacher.
Let's go to your calls now for Will Brown of Jax Today. What are your thoughts about this? 549-2937. Beckett in Jacksonville. Hi, Beckett. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. I'm a college student right now, but I took maybe 15 AP classes in high school. Mm-hmm. And I just think that it feels like a direct slap to the face of anyone who's interested in history and interested of the influence that American history has on current affairs. I did feel like what the governor in Illinois said was important, what he said about how the AP board shouldn't push back. I agree with that. I felt his other statements, though, on how Florida laws are meant to be homophobic and racist, I felt, you know, maybe that wasn't particularly nice, right? But it definitely has some standing. And I just hope that if Ron DeSantis does run for president, something will be done and that this curriculum will be reverted back.
Thanks, Beckett. And by the way, congratulations on being such a smarty pants.
15
AP classes.
Wow.
Good job, Beckett. Good to hear from a student's point of view. We want to hear from adults, too, although that is a young adult, of course, and it's 549-2937. Larry in Middleburg. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment and ask a question. Is there other so-called, I guess, cultures studied or offered in schools? And is being African-American considered a culture? Or would a Chinese-American be considered a culture? Or would it just be American culture? So it needs to be equal that any race would have that opportunity to be studied, their culture or their history in America.
Thanks. Thank you for that question.
There are other courses devoted to other histories that are part of the pilot program, as is my understanding. Now, recalling them off the top of my head is something I can't do, but I can say with certainty that to answer that question, there are other other cultures that their AP courses of their history, that their AP courses for as part of this pilot program. So I understand his point that, yes, obviously, you know, Black history is not the entirety of American history. Part of American history that's not taught is the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. That's a very massive part of our history because so many people of Chinese descent helped build the railroad that connected the Midwest and the West Coast. So that is something that's not often taught in schools as well. And that has nothing to do with Black people, but is a part of American history that is often ignored.
Sure. And different ethnic groups have faced all manner of struggles coming into this country, all manner of discrimination. And that needs to be taught in high schools. And at the same time, I think you could also make the argument that the Black experience in America is unique. And so the rationale for a course going more deeply into Black history, given that this nation was founded on the evils of slavery and also, let's be clear, the genocide of Native Americans. And so there is a unique argument to be made about Black history, well, I think. But, you know, at the same time, getting back to the state's point of view, they want the removal of content on what they say is unacceptable: critical race theory, Black queer studies, intersectionality, reparations, and other topics that violate our laws. So they object to some of this piloted curriculum.
I'd pay real money if James Baldwin was still with us. He'd have a lot to say.
The author.
Yes, the author and poet, James Baldwin. His thoughts on the so-called Black queer studies being a part of a point of contention would be fascinating to hear.
There was a rally yesterday in the Florida Capitol protesting the decision to reject this course. And as I said, a lawsuit is likely on the way, joining a long list of lawsuits sparked by the DeSantis administration. And let's go to John in, or he's not in the queue yet. Let's go to Daryl in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Daryl.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, this just seems to be the same pattern by DeSantis. Anybody or group that he doesn't believe is going to vote for him, or he knows is not going to vote for him, he's going to weaponize the government to attack them. Whether you're transgender, whether you're gay, whether you're Black, whether you're a former felon, we're going to arrest you for voting fraud. And they're just using the government to attack the citizens. And that's what he's doing. And it also stimulates, you know, the lower white class. Yeah, get them people. Attack the gays. That's all he's doing. He's just attacking the people that aren't going to support him.
Daryl, thanks. Oh, referring back to what I mentioned about the Illinois governor, Governor Pritzker, educational controversies in Florida are becoming pieces of a potential presidential candidate's strategy to wedge on these divisive issues in American life, to raise his national profile. And at the same time, it's giving his potential opponents an arsenal to work with, too. The problem with all of that, of course, though, if you're coming at this from the perspective of a Florida student or a Florida teacher, is they are pawns in this game.
Yes. And I feel for teachers who have to try and figure out, okay, what can we teach? What are we allowed to say? I feel horrible for students because they're not allowed to know. They're not given the opportunity to just be curious about things. And an example of being, I was a university student at the time, but an example of being curious is, and I think students of all ages do this, is I was a student and I remember walking past a library at Florida A&M University and said, College of Law. I said, why does that say College of Law right here at Coleman Library on the campus of Florida A&M University? I then went and read and found out that the Florida A&M College of Law was systemically defunded so that a College of Law could be created at Florida State University. That is the type of curiosity, but that is what courses like this will do. It might not teach, yes, it'll teach facts, but it'll teach students to be curious, and not just this course, but other courses as well.
On Facebook, Tyler says, kids and teachers having to fill out ideological exams, books being banned, teachers having to get rid of their classroom libraries. None of this is freedom. On Twitter, Susie says, Florida offers AP courses in European history, Chinese language and culture, Italian, German, and Japanese language and culture. We will confirm that, but thank you so much for pointing that out to us. A listener emails the show, if they are teaching about reparations, they should teach the arguments both for and against, and he doesn't believe that would be done in this class. Let's take one more call, if we can get John in St. John's County. Hi, John.
Yes, good morning.
Go ahead.
Another angle that's not being pursued in this is the fact that my son, who is National Honor Society and AP, if he decides to give a report on the Constitution and say he does a presentation in class, and he focuses on the 3/5 clause that says, you know, black people are not full human beings, or he decides to write a paper on it. If he's doing the lecture and the teacher says, shut up, sit down, you can't do that, or the paper's filled with factual points and he gets a failing grade because the teacher doesn't allow that, that is outrageous and grounds for a tremendous lawsuit. It's interfering with freedom of speech. It's personal prejudices brought into a classroom. What about the students' perspective, those people who are curious? It's just not addressed.
Thank you, John. As I mentioned, this latest salvo is likely to be challenged on First Amendment grounds, along with a host of other policies in Florida. We'll have to continue to follow it. Your final thoughts?
I want to leave with something that I read in the National in the Black History Museum in Washington, D.C., that shook me to my core. In 1860, enslaved people produced over 60% of the nation's wealth, and the slave trade was valued at $2.7 billion in 1860. That's a part of history that students don't often know unless they travel to a place like Washington, D.C. and read it in a museum.
Will Brown of JAX Today, thank you.
Thank you.
And much more still ahead later. The Donna Marathon turns 20 and turns up the pink next month, but up next.
A lot of what I feel my job is as an artist and as a photographer is to not only enlighten myself about things that I wasn't aware of, but to try to show what exists to other people without really imposing. I didn't want to tell people how to think about it, but I wanted to let what was there kind of speak for itself.
A conversation with Jacksonville photographer Doug Eng coming up about his new Creeks Rising exhibit opening at the Jesse Ball DuPont Center at the end of the month. We'll be right back. Well, our producer, Brendan Rivers, recently sat down with local photographer Doug Eng to discuss his new series, Creek Rising. It shines a light on McCoy's and Hogan's Creek in downtown Jacksonville. Let's take a listen to some of that conversation.
All right. Well, first of all, thanks for joining us.
That's good to be here.
Yeah. So for our listeners who may not be familiar with you and your work, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your art?
My name is Doug Eng. I'm a native and resident of Jacksonville. I had a former career as an engineer and software developer, but after I returned and retired, I decided to pursue an interest in photography.
So tell us about your series, Creeks Rising, and the inspiration behind it.
When I had a show at the museum 2 years ago, one of my dear friends who lives in Springfield came and saw the exhibit. And after we were done walking through it, he said, Doug, I'd like to show you something. And we got in his car and he drove me through Springfield, East Side, and along Hogan's Creek. And, you know, sometimes it takes some type of exposure, or you don't realize things are the way they are until you're sort of confronted with them. And I was really surprised at my reaction to what I was seeing. And I had memories of Hogan's Creek growing up, and I remember those bridges going across and sort of the parks around it, but I didn't realize the condition that it was in. And after we had finished that tour, I turned to my friend. I said, I think I'd like to look at this a little bit further. And I think it was the next day I returned with my camera. And, you know, when I have a camera with me, I get into this different mode, and I'm very introspective, and I'm able to start looking at things differently. And as I was walking along Hogan's Creek and seeing what was there, I decided that, you know, I'm just going to record what I was seeing. And I think there's one view, I think it's on East Monroe, which is sort of this little temporary bridge near the in back of the Maxwell House Coffee. And as I was looking at that view of the creek and just trying to take it all in, that's when, you know, it kind of just hit me as to what a beautiful place it was. And there was a lot of natural beauty there, but how either through neglect or just disinterest by our city that we've just allowed it to become as it was. And as I began photographing up and down, I decided, well, I'm going to start at the headwaters. I'm going to try to find that. I'm just going to walk the whole thing. And Hogan's is very walkable. So, you know, you can cover it. And, you know, going, I think I started in August, so it was extremely hot. And, you know, I'd go out just different times of the day and just try to find different things along the creek. I found a lot. So I thought it would be important to sort of document what I was seeing. And then as I had these prints up in my studio, a lot of people came by to see it, and they were surprised too. And I think a lot of what I feel my job is as an artist and as a photographer is to not only enlighten myself about things that I wasn't aware of, but to try to show what exists to other people without really imposing. I didn't want to tell people how to think about it, but I wanted to let what was there kind of speak for itself. And I think everyone sort of got the same message that, wow, this is could be a wonderful resource for the city, but wow, it doesn't look very good. And why is it that this body of water going through the middle of our city is in such a condition, and why isn't anything being done about it? So that's when I started really looking into not only the history of the creek, and if you look at the neighborhoods in Jacksonville and sort of that long history of where we've been and how things have changed, the story became even more interesting. And then another friend of mine suggested, well, you should look at all the urban creeks in Jacksonville, because their stories around all of those things. So I started looking at McCoy's Creek. And at that time, groundwork had already begun, the construction of the Emerald Trail through there. So there was construction going on, a lot of activity. Groundwork had already done a lot of the planning and research. So a lot of that information was available. But walking that creek, too, also enlightened me as to how, you know, an urban creek especially affected the neighborhoods it was going through, and also when it started intersecting with business and industry, and how the creek had to change or was changed, and then the whole history behind that. And that's very unfortunate in many, many ways as to how that body of water had changed and degraded. So in cooperation with Groundwork, we first had this shown at the Museum of Contemporary Art last summer, and then we wanted to bring it back to really tie into the Hogan's Creek renovation work that Groundwork is doing and the Emerald Trail. Thought it would be useful for people to see kind of hopefully the before, what exists today, and really the impetus for, the renovation of these areas and how important it's going to be and how much it's going to affect.
And for any listeners who might not be aware, the Emerald Trail is this 30-mile network of trails, greenways, and parks that's being built by Groundwork Jacksonville and the city itself. And as you said, this Creeks Rising exhibit was on display last year at MoCA. What was the reaction to the exhibit? Did you get any feedback on it?
Yeah, I think a lot of people were had approached me and not only said, well, thank you for doing it and for documenting it, but, you know, hopefully the right people can see it. Sometimes you need a photograph or the realization that of what is existing in order to focus attention to it. It allows a conversation to shift, once you have a view of something that exists in a physical form. You can actually start talking about it, pointing to it, making observations about it. So I think that was the value of it. And certainly for me, being able to meet a lot of people who, there are lots of people in Jacksonville that have been working on downtown revitalization, especially with these creeks, Emerald Trail, all of those projects. And it's so encouraging not only to be more aware of what's going on and that people do share that common love for the city and willing to put their time, effort, and money into doing something for the city, but, to be actually part of it.
And as you said earlier, as an artist, you almost feel like you have a responsibility to kind of educate your audience and raise awareness. And this is another example of many of your works that have focused specifically on environmental issues and environmental challenges. Why is it that you're so focused on the environment?
Well, I guess it's so important to me. As you mentioned, responsibility of artists, and I think artists have a unique place in our culture to where, we can probably have the means to communicate things that other people may not be as convenient for them. For me, the natural environment, certainly of Northeast Florida, has always been, one of the things that that I really cherish and that's been very important to me, not only for my own well-being, but it kind of defines where we are as a place. It's our beaches, our creeks, our the forests, and, to see where there's a situation where either through neglect or public policy or people's behaviors are adversely affecting that which is important to us. I think bringing some awareness to it will allow people to either modify their behaviors or to seek out the organizations that are actually working hard to do something about it. And I'm very happy to contribute to that.
All right, and tell us a little bit about this event coming up on the 31st.
It's an opening, so I'll be there and I'll probably say a few words about it. But I think it will allow those people who really aren't familiar with Groundwork and what they're doing on the Emerald Trail and with the Hogan's Creek renovation to be able to come and talk to some people at Groundwork and certainly to sign up as a volunteer or to donate. You know, a lot of people just aren't aware that this organization exists or organizations like this. And I think if we get out a little bit and if this is important to you, I think it's a great event to meet some people, to see the work that I've done, and to also be introduce themselves to the DuPont Center, which is the old Hayden Burns Library. They did a marvelous job at the renovation of that building, and there's a lot of history of Jacksonville. And those of you who are born and raised here have a lot of memories of being in that library, probably, certainly for me. And it's just, it's neat to be there. It's Jacksonville history.
Again, that was our own Brendan Rivers speaking with Jacksonville photographer Doug Eng. Eng will speak about his Creeks Rising exhibit at a reception coming up January 31st at the Jesse Ball DuPont Center. It'll be up through May 5th. Well, the city's March elections are just around the corner. We continue our profiles of some local candidates on the ballot as we welcome Kim Stevens Perry, Democrat and candidate for Jacksonville City Council District 10. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you.
Thank you, Melissa.
This is your first run for office. You're an IT executive at CSX. Why'd you decide to get in the race?
Well, I've been sitting on the fence for a while, working with the Northwest CPAC. And so my experience with the Northwest CPAC has led me to want to get into the race and run for city council.
And what happened with your experience that led you to think you could, you know, make some contributions to your district, which is on the north side?
Right, right. So working with the Northwest CPAC over the last few years, we've had a few initiatives come through from the city where various business owners wanted to either bring a business into our community or make some adjustments. And based on the constituents' desire, the city went in opposition. The last ordinance that came through is a owner wanted to bring a liquor store into the community. And there's a city ordinance that says liquor stores shall not be more than within 500 feet of a church. Mm-hmm. This matter went before the planning commissioners, and the planning commissioners was the only stop for this. In opposition to the community, the planning commissioners approved for this business owner to place a liquor store within 401 feet of a church. So they reduced the footage. With that in mind, I thought to myself, in order for us to get the respect that we need and desire in our communities, we had to put some skin in the game. So with the community support, I went and hired a land use and zoning attorney. Mm-hmm. And that attorney appealed the decision. Mm-hmm. And we won. Mm-hmm. And after that, I thought it's time to get in the game because our representatives are not listening to us.
And you're campaigning on improving infrastructure, enhancing quality of life, and attracting new business to
yes.
your district.
Yes, I am.
Tell us about that.
Well, I feel that our issues are related to lack of economics. We have, when North Jacksonville went through consolidation, there were promises made that have yet to be fully fulfilled. So I feel that with me being elected, I would focus on bringing those economics back into our community. This community was once a thriving community when I was a young person. And from an infrastructure perspective, those bringing dollars into the community will help us to move old homes off of the septic tanks. I live in a neighborhood that's still on a septic tank. We're near the water. And I know I have at least one elderly neighbor whose septic tank is failing. She has a well and she cannot afford to move herself off of it or even correct the problem.
This is still such a widespread issue, just lack of basic modern infrastructure in big parts of the city. So What do you think the city council should be doing more aggressively than they are currently to remediate these problems? What would you propose specifically?
I would propose specifically, you may have heard just recently in the news where one of the Cure Violence sites has been shut down. And that site is based in my community, North Jacksonville, in District 10. There is about $500,000 remaining, and the current proposal is to move it to the west side. Those dollars should remain in the district and be utilized to either move folks off a septic tank or remediate their septic systems if they cannot be connected to the city sewage yet.
What, going beyond infrastructure and attracting new jobs, you know, there are a lot of candidates running in this cycle, and we could see some new faces on the city council. There's been a lot of criticism of the city council. What do you think city leaders should be doing to restore trust in our local leadership?
I think in order to restore trust is that you're elected by the people and you should listen to the people. And that's how I feel the trust can be restored, if we take into consideration what the constituent is wanting.
And you don't believe our current crop of leadership is doing that?
No, I don't. Just the other evening, I was listening to city council, and there is an issue up in the Black Hammock area where there is a developer wants to go in and put in
about in environmentally sensitive land.
Oh my
gosh.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So you see that as one example of
them not listening.
Well, I appreciate you coming in, and we'll continue our series of profiling candidates running in the March elections. Kim Stevens-Perry, candidate for District 10. Thanks.
Thank you, Melissa.
And when we come back, the Donna Foundation celebrates 20 years. We'll be right back.
Our monthly medical roundtable. I'm Dr. Joe Servin. Join me Saturday at 4 for What's Health Got to Do with It? Only on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville.
Northeast Florida artists are making noise that's reverberating across the country, and the Jacksonville Music Experience is your ticket to the local scene. Music reviews, curated playlists, music history, concert recommendations, and profiles of local artists, all put together by our team of local contributors. The Jacksonville Music Experience plays it local and plays it loud. Visit jacksmusic.org to read and hear more.
Late Night Show Jimmy Kimmel Live has been on air for 20 years, and it's still going.
I was almost sure I was going to stop. I was nearly positive, because part of it's just OCD. Just 20 years sounds right.
I'm Ari Shapiro. We take a trip to Jimmy Kimmel's office and look back on his career on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tomorrow, starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Thea Deepa Fernandez, Iranian-American filmmaker Mariam Keshavarz tells us the story of fierce Iranian women in her new film premiering at Sundance, and they are not on the front lines of the protests, they're right in her family.
Even with gender apartheid, they have found a way to continue to develop their voice and to be a presence in their culture.
Next time, Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
The late night show Jimmy Kimmel Live has been on air for 20 years and it's still going.
I was almost sure I was going to stop. I was nearly positive because part of it's just OCD. Just 20 years sounds right.
I'm Ari Shapiro. We take a trip to Jimmy Kimmel's office and look back on his career on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tomorrow, starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
The Sundance Film Festival is back, and half of what's being shown has been made by first-time filmmakers. For its debut, Pretty Baby, a documentary about Brooke Shields in Hollywood, brought the crowd in Utah to its feet.
I don't have anger in my heart because I knew it was about them.
Highlights from the Sundance Film Festival that's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the Donna Marathon will turn up the pink all across town starting February 3rd. Now in its 16th year, the theme of the 2023 Donna Marathon weekend is Destination Donna, aimed at celebrating Jacksonville as a beautiful destination race, bringing thousands of runners to town from all over the world. The vision, of course, of the Donna Foundation is a future without breast cancer, as that foundation celebrates its 20th anniversary this year. Amanda Napolitano is Executive Director of the Donna Foundation. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Of course, we must disclose that your organization's founder, Donna Deegan, is running for local political office, running for mayor. So tell us about this year's 26-2 with Donna Marathon weekend.
We are celebrating our Sweet 16 this year, and I am so excited. I can't believe it's 10 days from today. We're going to kick things off with a new venue destination in downtown Jacksonville with the Jacksonville Jaguars. We're going to host our expo in the Flex Field on Friday and Saturday, and the 5K and Donna Dash on Saturday in and out of the stadium. I'm so excited about that.
Very nice. So You'll have some Jaguars coming off an incredible season to give you a little extra juice.
That's right. That's right. No better feeling than starting and finishing a race in that bowl, right? With all of the jumbotrons and the energy of the Jags.
Okay, so over the last 16 years, the funds raised from this marathon have helped support nearly 20,000 local families living with breast cancer, which is what this is all about.
It is what it's all about, Melissa. You know, sadly, so many of us. Struggle to make ends meet with a breast cancer diagnosis, where patients are having to choose between putting food on the table and getting the treatment that they need. And so the Donna Foundation steps in and supports these families through the Donna Care Line. We pay for financial critical needs while people are journeying through their cancer. Mm-hmm. And yes, over the last 20 years, we have served nearly 18,000 families, 2,000 every year in securing about $600,000 in financial services for those families each and every year.
Okay. And this weekend, the Donna Marathon weekend, as you mentioned, a new location downtown to kick things off,
mm-hmm.
and a new race route at the beach for the actual event?
Yes. So the National Marathon and Half Marathon to Finish Breast Cancer will start and finish at Seawalk Pavilion in Jacksonville Beach. That is not new. We did this last year. What's new is that the marathon is a double loop design this year. And so the field will run up north into Neptune Beach and Atlantic Beach. All of the noise and energy, mm-hmm. 26.2 block beach party. It's so much fun. And then the marathon runners will actually do that again. They'll go through a second loop. So beaches, communities, get ready.
It's coming up
on Sunday.
Everybody's getting ready to run. Now, you estimate this race has contributed nearly $60 million in economic impact to the city of Jacksonville.
That's correct.
Putting Jacksonville on a global map in terms of drawing runners from all over the globe.
That's correct, yes. We have a partnership with an organization called Destination Marathons this year. And, you know, they're hosting VIP experience packages for people that are coming in from everywhere. Every year we drive an estimated $3 to $5 million in economic impact to our city.
Okay. So with all of that said, if you haven't registered yet, you can register to run as part of Donna the Marathon Weekend. But you don't have to run the full 26.2 miles. There are other options too, right?
Indeed. We have a Donna Dash. That's great for families. 1 mile at the stadium. We have a 5K. And the marathon and half marathon on Sunday. The half marathon is open for 7 hours, so it's perfect if you want to walk.
And the website, of course, is breastcancermarathon.com. Which one do you do, Amanda?
I do the marathon of directing everything for the weekend. I am an avid runner. I love to run. But on that particular weekend, I like to stand in the finish line and hug everybody.
Well, have fun. Amanda Napolitano, Executive Director of the Donna Foundation, celebrating 20 years in Jacksonville, and the 2023 Donna Marathon Weekend is coming up now in its 16th year. Get ready, beaches, as you said.
Get ready. We're coming.
And thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks also to our team. They run a marathon on this show every day. It feels like we climb Mount Everest just a little bit. David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Brendan Rivers, Isabella Da Silva, and Michelle Corum. Drop us a line anytime at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for the company. Make it a great day, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.